Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have the good fortune of speaking with Steve Keen, professor of economics and finance at the University of Western Sydney, and author of the popular book Debunking Economics and the website Steve Keen's Debt Watch. I've long been an avid reader and follower of Steve's work over the years because it's logical and starts with the data. Steve's research focuses on the dynamics of debt and leads him to believe that debt deflation is the key issue that will continue to dictate what happens in the global economy. I'm really looking forward to discussing deflation, his new book, maybe something of his recent debate with Paul Krugman, and whether the global markets are rolling over as we're speaking today. Steve, it's a pleasure to have you as our guest.
Great to be back on again, Chris.
Oh, fantastic. So let's start right at the outset. If you could give a summary for those who are not familiar with your work. You say debt deflation is the key issue. Can you give us a summary of your views?
Yeah, well, a capitalist economy necessarily has banks. That's news to conventional economists, but the rest of us are quite used to that. And banks create spending power by creating debt, so you can actually have a boom being driven by banks lending money at a faster rate than the economy itself is growing, which gives you accumulation of debt, getting to be a higher and higher ratio of debt to GDP. And you get to the point where that can't continue any longer, where you can't get new borrowers. And when you reach that point, you go through a turning point, then with people who've normally been enticed into the debt to borrow money to gamble on rising asset prices, instead find asset prices are falling and try to liquidate, and you then have a period where debt levels are reduced, and rather than rising debt adding to demand as it does during the boom phase, during the depression phase, it's not a slump, it's a depression, people are spending less than they earn, and therefore aggregate demand is less than income, and you have a declining level of demand all the way through as asset prices collapse and debt's gradually paid back down. That's what gave us the 1930s, and we began the 1930s crisis with, in America, a debt-to-GDP ratio of roughly 175%. And thanks to the machinations of Greenspan and co., we began this particular downturn with a peak level of debt of 303% of GDP. So just as it took about 15 years to get out of the last Great Depression, this one, which Americans are still calling the Lesser Depression now, I notice, could last even longer than the Great Depression unwind did.
This time with extra debt, 50% more. So in this story, then, there's a math problem, and the math problem is that you can't borrow more than your income. If your debts are growing at a faster rate than your income, sooner or later you have a math problem. You're saying we reached that math problem in 2008. Do you agree with that? And secondarily, was there a trigger, an event that sort of precipitated that, or do these things just sort of happen randomly?
It's an endogenous thing. You don't require an external event, because to continue having more and more debt being taken on, you've got to time people who are willing to acquire that debt. And initially, the level of debt that households had back in the 1990s was relatively low, about 40% of GDP. They were then enticed into the subprime bubble, and you had debt levels for the household sector driven up towards about 100% of GDP. To continue the bubble going, you need not to have not just rising debt, but accelerating debt. And this is why it always has to break down, because for debt to accelerate indefinitely, you'd have to get to the stage where a debt-to-income ratios were infinite. Now, of course, that can't happen. So as soon as you start to exhaust the supply of people who are willing to go into debt, as you have more and more of society becoming indebted, a simple slowdown in the rate of growth of that is enough to turn the acceleration negative, and that's what drives the whole economy down. So if you take a look at the data, I think you've got to look at three factors of debt: the absolute level, the rate of growth of debt, and whether that rate of growth is accelerating or decelerating. And in fact, the crisis begins as soon as the rate of acceleration consistently decelerates and goes from getting faster to growing more slowly. And that's what sets the crisis off. So that actually began right pretty much at the beginning of 2008. But of course, part of the other trigger as well is that a large part of this money that debt was created was then put into ventures, which themselves were losing money. So you had the subprime crisis where we know people were borrowing amounts of money they could never repay. They were necessarily going bankrupt. There were losses being made by speculative ventures elsewhere as well. Those losses accumulate and have to be serviced, or you've got to go bankrupt and write the debts off. So those triggers were all sitting there, but they're all well and truly internal. It didn't take a meteor from Mars to cause this crisis.
Well, so I plant the seeds of this stretching back a long ways. I'm most familiar with U.S. debt. At this point, I know that starting in 1970 through the next four decades, over those four decades, total credit market debt, which includes financial and non-financial, that doubled five complete times in that period of time. And, of course, the economy did not double anywhere close to five complete times. Mm. And so that rolled over around in 2008. And so just to get back on that trajectory, to get back to what people would call normal, for budgets to operate like we expect them to, capital markets, the whole shebang, I would estimate that we would have to double again, let's call it in a decade. So from 2008 to 2018, the U.S. has to figure out how to accumulate 50-some-odd trillion dollars of new incremental debt. I don't know even what we would possibly lend it to ourselves for. The total housing bubble was still only in a $10, $11 trillion market. Do you see any opportunities out there for us to take on the kinds of debt that seem to be required to rescue this system?
No, you can't go back to business as usual. This is the real trap of a debt bubble, because the thing that actually entices people into that much debt is the expectation that asset markets can continue rising. If you look at debt that people take out relative to their income, you know, if you're personal loans and stuff like that, despite all the enticements to take out credit cards, you know, would you like an increase in your credit limit with that, like going to McDonald's and getting extra fries? Banks were trying to pump out higher credit limits all the time. Deals on buying cars, you know, buy now, pay later, et cetera, et cetera. Despite all of that, the ratio of unsecured personal debt to income has been flat line, but it certainly hasn't gone on an exponential rise. The only form of debt that rises exponentially compared to incomes is debt which is being used to buy an asset where you believe that the asset is going to increase in price and you can sell it for a higher amount of money than you paid to buy it in the first place. So you expect to get a capital gain, which really is a Ponzi gain. You know, you don't do anything, but you get money for it. Now that you get, that's what drives asset prices up. So we had the biggest bubble in stock market history and the biggest bubble in housing market history simultaneously. Having reached that peak, because you can no longer have accelerating debt driving up those prices further, they are now falling, and that's going to encourage people out of debt. So far from seeing a way in which you're likely to get people back in again, the asset market bubble being over, that is going to drive people out of debt rather than entice them to take on more. So business as usual, as it was for the last 40 years, can't be restored.
You know, very interesting in that I note that one of the places that I date sort of a recent stumble in all of this, yes, it's a four-decade-long credit bubble, but in 1994, we had a real issue in the credit markets, particularly corporate bonds, and Greenspan took that moment to implement something called the sweeps program, which enabled banks to effectively dodge the reserve requirements, as minimal as they were, entirely, which enabled a brand new gigantic round of liquidity to take off. So we had the stock bubble, and of course that met its fate, and then that led to another round of ultra-cheap money and ultimately led to a housing bubble. And so my view of this is that we started with relatively small crises that, with the application of more sugar, more monetary heroin, whatever metaphor we're using here, that just begat an even larger problem that required an even larger stimulus. And so here we are now globally looking at coordinated central bank interventions where in the past 6 years, the balance sheets of just the six largest central banks have expanded by some, $10 trillion. Do you think that they can realistically keep this game going much longer?
Well, they can prevent people going insolvent by giving somebody who's bankrupt cash, and that's pretty much what they've been doing with bailing out the banks, bailing out the bondholders. So they can continue doing that indefinitely because, of course, just as banks can create money, commercial banks can create money just by double-entry bookkeeping, so can central banks, and they don't face any limits at all. Not even their profitability is not a limit to them, of course. So they can keep on doing this indefinitely. But what they're hoping to have happen, and this is what's going to fail, is they hope that by doing it, the system will suddenly kickstart itself, a bit like a lawnmower, which you You know, you continue pulling on the cable to try to get the thing to start, pull a few more times, put a bit more fuel in, it'll finally fire up and then it'll go of its own volition. That's what's not going to happen. They're going to have to continue pumping money back in again. And, of course, each time they then stop and hope it'll flood into life itself, because the basic trend for the public sector is to reduce its debt levels, it'll fold once more back into a slump. So they can keep on doing it indefinitely, but I think we'll continue indefinitely succeeding while they're doing it and failing as soon as they hope that the system can take over on its own.
So spell it out for me. Why exactly is it that this engine will not sputter back to life?
Because too much debt's already in there, and people, because they no longer see a way of rising debt, meaning a gain on the asset markets for themselves, they're going to be trying to reduce their debt, particularly if asset markets are in fact falling. They're going to be reducing their gearing, reducing their leverage, and every time you kickstart the system with a bit of extra money, or a lot of extra money, and hope to get it started once more, once you stop injecting that government-created money into the system will then go to the stage where it takes money out, because to pay your debt down, you have to take money out of circulation. Therefore, economic activity will fall again, and rather than booming, will go back to faltering once more.
So perhaps in a microcosm, if we look at what's happening in Spain today, where we note that they've got an extraordinary debt-to-GDP ratio, they've got really dismal economic prospects, they've got a banking system that's really weak, if not mortally wounded, they've just nationalized Bankia. Is Spain a good metaphor here for what maybe the larger world is going to experience?
I think America's still the best metaphor because, and therefore nothing metaphor, we're talking the actual story, because Spain, as part of the euro, and the euro is another catastrophe on top of the overall catastrophe of private banking funding Ponzi schemes. So the real story is the commercial banks generating money, making profit for themselves by creating debt and persuading us into far too much debt by the asset bubbles that did growth in debt itself actually caused for prices to rise. And, of course, Greenspan's rescue is making this process go on for far longer than it would have done without that particular government intervention. But Spain is caught up with the euro, where just as neoclassical economists are responsible for the scale of the crisis by making us turn a blind eye to rising debt, they also drafted the economic components of the treaty to bring about the European Union. And that treaty basically embodied the neoclassical fantasy that a market economy works best if there's no government intervention, no government policy. So they set up a system which the governments couldn't do exchange rate policy because they're all part of the one currency, so you can't devalue against each other. You can't do monetary policy because the European Central Bank is in control of that and sets an interest rate for the entire continent of Europe. And you can't do fiscal policy either because the Maastricht Treaty said the maximum deficit you could run is 3% of GDP, and the maximum accumulated deficit you could have is 60% of GDP, talking of public debt there. So it meant you push Europe together and said you can have neither fiscal nor monetary nor exchange rate policy, and we're going to have the most wonderful world. Well, look what's happened. It's the greatest catastrophe on the planet. So Spain is an additional catastrophe. Like, in some ways, it's America squared.
America squared, but America is maybe the better metaphor because it's not a metaphor. We can talk about it directly.
Yeah, it's the real story. Yeah, everything, America's big enough, even though it's deindustrialized massively through the last 30 or 40 years to under the cover of this financialization of the economy, it is, and even though it has a much larger import bill than it used to have as a result of that, it is still pretty much a self-contained economy. And what's going on there is an entirely endogenous process of the banks creating too much debt, funding an asset market bubble, and now we're caught up in the deleveraging from that, and we're back in another Great Depression.
Well, the idea, I guess, so to start to spin over into this great debate that's been brewing with the neoclassical economists, who, by the way, have been just spectacularly wrong, yet to hear a qualified, reasonable mea culpa from that crew yet. If I could summarize, they seem to be saying any failures in policy that and traction that we're not seeing so far is simply because we didn't do enough. Enough of what? What exactly? So you've mentioned that some of the strategy here was sort of delay and pray, right? So we just kick the can long enough and pray, and maybe the economy sputters back to life all on its own. But there have been a number of other dynamics driving this, with taking what were private debts and pushing them over onto the public side of the balance sheet with direct monetization of government debt by central banks, and in particular the Federal Reserve, very, very large quantities. What exactly is the strategy here?
This is the intriguing thing, because the strategy is panic. The neoclassical economists believe the economy is self-equilibrating. We'll always return to equilibrium after any minor shock, and they really regard the global financial crisis as just a really big shock that for some reason continues remaining negative, and they can't work out why. And in fact, if they actually had their druthers, they would have druthered done nothing back at the time of the 2007 crisis, except that, according to the theories, that crisis shouldn't even have happened. So what happened when the crisis hit? You had people who were neoclassical and vehemently anti-government spending suddenly became born-again Keynesians and threw as much money as they could at the system, hoping that we'd get it over this temporary crisis. And then when they've done that, and they got a bit of a recovery for a while, the sheer scale of government spending was far, far greater than the Great Depression, and therefore you had a boost to aggregate demand coming out of the government's behaviour. But then they thought they could sit back and watch it start booming once more. And rather than booming, of course, we've had an economy which I guess, it basically splutters. So normally after a standard post-Second World War recession, where, you know, growth is negative for a couple of quarters, you normally get a rebound, whereas it's been up to about 5 and 6% growth on an annual basis per quarter for a few quarters, at least after the slump. And the best they've managed so far is about 3. Of course, we're falling back to the stage where it's 1 and may even hit negative again. So their response was to abandon their principles, so-called, and go for government spending and then pray that that would be enough to get the system started again. And they're basically flummoxed as to why it hasn't worked.
You know, I'm going to note that I think Keynes is getting a bad rap in this.
He is getting a bad rap, yeah.
I've read some of his works, and he's clearly a very intelligent person, and I'm going to go out on a fat limb and suggest that he would not ever support the idea of trying to exponentially grow and increase your debts faster than your income. He was clearly too smart for that.
Keynes was aware of the dangers there. And Keynes, I often said, people like Paul Krugman call themselves new Keynesians, him and Woodford and Thomer and so on and so forth. As I wrote in the Debunking Economics, if they can call themselves Keynesians, then I can call myself a duck because I can say the word quack. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no way in which they reflect what Keynes actually wrote. And ironically, you read them and they say, well, they don't care what Keynes actually wrote. They call this Talmudic research. Well, I'm sorry, knowing what somebody said is an essential before you can use their name as a label for what you do. But in fact, they don't do that. They simply think, oh, this looks like what Keynes what I think Keynes said according to a textbook I read a few years ago. I'll call myself a Keynesian. I'm sorry, but they're better off calling themselves ducks because they really are quacks.
Way to bring it all together. So if we could, just for a minute, there was a very public debate with a New York Times economist. I'm putting air quotes up here on this. I guess he is an economist, but Paul Krugman. And at one point, I was reading through his blog, and he was defending the idea that banks cannot create money out of thin air. He may have backtracked a bit on that, but it was a very odd debate. I didn't quite understand ultimately what was being really argued there. Can you help us out?
Yeah. Well, the basic neoclassical attitude is that banks don't matter. Banks are just simply intermediaries between savers and borrowers. So you don't actually, all the bank does is act as a conduit. It doesn't actually create money. Now, he then went to the labor, well, of course it does create money in the money multiplier sense. So if the government gives an unemployed person a dole check, they go bank the money at the bank. The bank hangs onto a bit of it, lends out a bit, and there's a money multiplier process that ultimately means they get to the stage where they finally have a ratio between their deposits and their reserves, which is the maximum level they can get to, and then they can't lend anymore until the government creates more reserves. So that's the sort of money creation model that Krugman believes, and neoclassical economists in general believe, that the banking sector is capable of. But they argue that the bank cannot simply create money beyond what the reserve systems allow it to do. And that's the conventional belief they have. Now, the position that I come from is to say that banks are unconstrained by the reserve system, and there's a number of reasons behind that. One of the simplest is, and this is actually the European Central Bank actually states this, the way reserves are calculated is as a lagged response to what's happened in the lending market. So the reserves are based on the deposits that were created at 2 weeks earlier, and in some cases, in America's case now, 30 days earlier. So in other words, it's after the banks have created new money, then the reserves they need to match the new money they've created are determined. So rather than reserves created first and deposits coming later, it's precisely the reverse way around. And that's the big mistake. It therefore means that banks can create money by double entry bookkeeping. So if you go to a bank and ask for a loan, the bank says, what do you want the money for? I've got this idea for a new, hydrogen-powered iPad. The bank says, that's a great idea. Here's $100 million. And by the way, you owe us $100 million. And they simultaneously create a loan and a deposit without having to take the money out of the account of any other savers. Now, that therefore means the $100 million you get to spend building this new hydrogen-powered iPad does not reduce the spending power of other people in society. It adds to it. And therefore, banks play an essential role in the real economy and in the models that I build of it as well, of actually adding to aggregate demand. And what they add to aggregate demand generally goes on two things. Investment, which would be a good thing, if indeed a hydrogen-powered iPad was a good idea, which it's not, but nonetheless, that would be a good investment. But it also goes on speculation, which means buying existing assets and using the borrowed money to bid up the prices. So that role of banks is an essential element of why we got into the crisis in the first place. But Krugman, it's quite an amazing to have him say this. He said he's all for putting in banks where they matter, but why do banks matter in a story about debt and leverage? Now, to me, that was a bit like saying, I'm all for considering wings on birds, but why do I need to worry about wings to work out why birds fly?
It's mysterious. It's just mysterious to me that there can be such a disconnect between what appears to be obvious conclusions from lots of data. This, you don't have to dig hard. It's all right there. So help me understand something then. As I watch I do something very arcane. I look at the monetary aggregates because I think there's still some information in that. And my prediction is that someday the velocity of money will turn around like it always does, and that'll be a moment to behold. So I'm watching, say, M2 or MZM, doesn't matter. They're still trundling up at an almost unbroken clip throughout this entire crisis. In fact, they even have some sharper upsloping periods during part of this crisis. So on that basis, it looks like there's still plenty of money sort of entering the system by hook or by crook, even as credit is declining. Well, mostly it's financial credit that's declined. How do we explain that?
Well, that one, I'm not sure. I kind of get a bit of ignorance there. Chris, I tend to take a look at the debt levels. To me, the essential act in creating new money is the creation of debt. Because they're created, debt and money are created as a sort of bonded pair when they begin, and then after the creation process, they're separated. So I'm looking at the level of new debt being created, and that is still declining. You're still getting the level of debt in the economy falling. Very, very slowly now. It's falling very rapidly when the crisis first began. So that's the main metric that I look at. The monetary aggregates, on the other hand, I tend to regard them as being caught up in the whole shadow banking sector and what's being done by the government in its rescue attempts. And I think there's so many black arts going on there that I just don't find that data reliable enough to worry about too much.
So yeah, I understand.
It does puzzle me. I have to defer to you on that one.
All right. Well, back to your earlier point, then, one of the other things that this double entry bookkeeping and credit expansion really does enable as well. If I look at the inflation adjusted expenditures of all the major OECD governments, they're all upwardly sloping lines for the past decade. So the other enabling feature of creating all of this money is to allow governments to not really have to figure out how to balance their books all that carefully. So everybody got to participate in this party, I assume.
Well, it's a bit different. There is a reason why debt should rise over time, but it should rise roughly at the same pace as income, faster sometimes, more slowly the other time. That's, I'm talking about private debt there. Because when you have a growing economy, it's because the growth is financed largely by the increase in debt financing investment, which then gives you technological improvements, new products, and so on, that is a reason to continue borrowing money. So we should normally expect the banks to be creating new debt most of the time, and only when the economy is actually in a recession would you see the level of debt falling. and that would be a healthy economy if we didn't have financing Ponzi schemes as well, and therefore rising exponentially faster than income. Now, the same thing applies for the government. If you have a mixed economy, you've got a combination of both private sector spending and government spending, private sector-created money and government-created money, you have to have the government creating additional money over time as well. And the major way it does that is by running a deficit. So the normal situation for a growing economy should be a deficit that means that the level of government money in the system remains roughly comparable to the level of private money. Instead, what we've had with this fixation on balancing the books, which would be the right thing to do if you had a static economy, that has actually led to the level of government money plunging over time. If you go back to the 1960s, and here I've got some memory of the levels of aggregates back then. Back in the 1960s, M0 was about 15% of the total money supply. And if you fast forward to just before the crisis, we're down to about 3%. Now, that was the government actually, because of this obsession with running surpluses during boom times and even during some slump times, reducing the amount of government money in circulation, letting the credit system go crazy. And then when the crisis hit, what does Bernanke do? He doubles the base money supply in 4 months. From the previous doubling took 13 years. And we got back to pretty much the same ratio as 1960 by the time we finished the pumping into the system. But it actually helped destabilize it in the period before that.
Let's imagine then when we see what's going on right now, you say credit is slowly falling. It's not growing at all, right? So if credit is falling slowly at this point, would you say that then the pressures on the global financial system, on markets, on the economy, the larger economy, are those pressures still growing at this point?
Yeah. So the reason that we have this trauma for the asset markets is because of this whole relationship that rising debt has to the level of asset markets. So if you think about the best example, the most direct one, is think about demand for housing. Where does it come from? It comes from new mortgages. So if you want to sustain the current price level of houses, you have to have a constant flow of new mortgages. If you want the price level to rise, you need the flow of mortgages to also be rising. So there's a correlation between accelerating debt and rising asset markets. And that correlation applies very, very directly to housing. If you look at the relationship over the 20-year period from 1990 through to now, the correlation of accelerating mortgage debt with changing house prices is 0.8, very, very high correlation over boom and bust, obviously, too. It's not quite so clear for the stock market, but it's still about 0.35. And given how volatile the stock market is, I find that's a remarkably high correlation anyway of aggregate debt to the change in the stock market. Now, that means that when there's a period where private debt is accelerating, you're generally going to see rising asset markets, which, of course, are what we had right up to 2000 for the stock market, and, of course, through 2006 for the housing market. Now that we have decelerating debt, so debt is actually, generally speaking, slowing down more rapidly over time rather than accelerating, that is going to mean falling asset markets. And because we have such a huge overhang of debt, that process of debt accelerating downwards, decelerating, you know, negative, is more likely to rule most of the time rather than going positive. And we will therefore find the asset markets traumatizing on the way down, which of course encourages people to get out of debt. So it's a positive feedback process on the way up. It's a positive feedback process on the way down.
And don't we have also something else contributing here where, any market, whether it's an asset market or a fish market, if you have more buyers than sellers, prices tend to go up. In the reverse, more sellers than buyers and prices tend to go down. And when I look at the demographics of the United States, also of Europe, people enter their peak earning years between the ages of 30 and 50. Mm-hmm. And then when you have more retirees than people behind them, or you have some sort of a demographic bulge, you generally will find, well, who are they going to sell their assets to as they want to fund their retirement? Mm-hmm. Japan, in many respects, is almost exactly 10, maybe 11 years ahead of the United States in terms of its population demographics. And they've been experiencing just horrible asset markets for a very sustained period. Bernanke certainly studied that and, you know, promised we wouldn't turn Japanese. Have we just turned Japanese?
Oh, well and truly. I mean, that sort of work is the stuff that Harry Dent's the expert in, of course. And it's very much a genuine part of the whole dynamic that I tend not to include in my own modeling, because if I included demographics, it would pretty much swamp everything else. And I want to focus upon the contribution the financial sector has made to its own suicide. Mm-hmm. But yes, when you have a demographic bulge, which, you know, the baby boomer period and so on, passing through the system, and now, of course, they're trying to sell, liquidate the assets they get in and get their retirement fund. But, of course, they're all doing it at once, and they're now finding, having driven asset markets up through high levels of debt, now they're trying to capitalize that and come out with an income for the future, they're going down again. Now, of course, when you have a declining population, you don't need to have more houses being built, and you can therefore have, you know, houses becoming empty, and that, of course, is going to put downward pressure on house prices, which may be a reason why Japan's house prices have fallen, I think now more than 70% from their peak in nominal terms. So an enormous decline over time. And we may face a similar thing in America, as you say, when the demographic bulge of the baby boomers is all the way through and we start getting to the, you know, the dinks part of society turning up. So that is a secular trend in addition to the cyclical phenomenon and bubble phenomenon of the stock market and of the financial sector funding a Ponzi scheme. And that's something we have never had to cope with before, as indeed is, of course, global warming and peak oil. But all these things coming together at once is an incredible cacophony of problems that makes me wonder whether I'm actually really on planet Earth or I'm caught in an episode of Star Trek.
Well, it certainly explains why the strategy is panic. And so if we cast into that cauldron of things that you just put out there, what I see is that we're trying to preserve the status quo. So we've dumped trillions and trillions of dollars. It doesn't seem to be working. As I read the current economic statistics, so here we are, it's June 4th. I'm looking across the global landscape. Last week, horrible week, right? So China's decelerating strongly. Japan's in a recession. Europe's in a recession. All the PMI statistics are down horribly in a contractionary territory. The United States is at stall speed. And against that backdrop, we have to sort of conclude maybe that printing efforts 1, 2, and LTRO 1 and 2 and all those other things have not worked. Where do you, you know, put on your prediction hat? Where are we in the story right now? And what do you see going on in the global economic landscape right now?
Well, Europe is imploding under its own volition, and I think that the euro is going to probably collapse at some stage or contract to being a northern euro rather than the whole of euro. We're going to probably see every government in Europe get overthrown and quite possibly have a return to fascist governments. We came very close to that with, you know, Greece getting, you know, fascists getting 5% of the vote from zero. Maybe left-wing coups as well. So political turmoil in Europe, that seems to be Europe's fate. I can see England going into a credit crunch this year because if you think America's level of debt is scary, you haven't seen England's level of debt. England has, you know, America has a maximum ratio of private debt to GDP of just over 300%. England's is 450%. America's financial sector debt was 120% of GDP. England's is 250%. It's the hot money capital of the Western world. And now that we're finally seeing decelerating debt turning up over there, plus the government running an austerity program at the same time, which means there's two factors pulling in demand out of the economy at once, I think at some stage there'll be a credit crunch in England, so that's going to take place as well. America is still caught in the deleveraging process. It tried to get out. It seemed to be working for a short while. The government stimulus certainly helped. Now that you're going back to reducing that stimulus, you're pulling out the one thing which was keeping demand up in the American economy. It's heading back down again. We're now seeing the asset markets crashing once more. That should cause a return to decelerating debt. For a while, you were accelerating very rapidly, and that gave you part of what gave you a boost in employment. So you're falling back down again. Australia is running out of steam because it got through the financial crisis by literally kicking the can down the road by restarting a housing bubble with a policy I call the first home vendors boost, where they gave first home buyers a larger amount of money from the government, and that, of course, they handed over times 5 or 10 to the people they bought the house off with the leverage they got from the banking sector. So that's finally run out for them. And China, which got through the crisis by an enormous stimulus package, I think in its case increasing its money supply by 28% in 1 year, setting off a huge property bubble, which from what I've heard from colleagues of mine, a good friend of mine, Craig Tyndale's published a little piece on that on my blog this week, that is also coming to an end. So I think it's a particularly ugly year for the global economy, and we're still trying to, as you say, to get back to business as usual. We're trying to rescue the creditors and restart the world dominated by the creditors. We have to rescue the debtors instead before we're ever going to see the end of this crisis.
Well, so what does deflation really look like? You know, I remember when it was 2008 and Hank Paulson marches into Congress, closes the door and says, if we don't fix this Lehman crisis, what we're going to have is martial law and Mad Max. I don't know. He was really using scare terms. And then, you know, I think it was a year after that or more, Mervyn King came out and said, oh, yeah, hey, by the way, we're just a few hours away from a really major banking snafu over here in England. It was really dicey, touch and go. And again, with the implication that there would be this systemic failure, everybody seems to sort of be afraid of systemic failure. And I don't know if that just means just all on their own, the banking system sort of dominoes its way down and we have lots of institutional failures, or there's some larger cataclysm involving derivatives that creates some sort of black hole of finance, or what are they, what in your mind, if deflation really seizes control and the central banks are impotent to really do anything next, what happens?
Well, the deflation is lower. This, you know, we have had deflation. It's lower than the last time round. In the 1930s, we had deflation running at 10% per annum for a couple of years there. And the major reason for that, I believe, is that in the 1930s, it was the business sector, the non-financial business sector, that was largely in debt. Its debt ratio when the crisis began was 125% of GDP. And therefore, businesses were the ones who were insolvent when the crisis hit. And their reaction was to cut their prices to try to drag in customers in through their doors rather than their neighbors' doors, because they all did it. And what you therefore saw was dramatically falling prices, and debt was paid down, but the prices fell faster than the debt fell. So you had really, really serious deflation. This time around, the non-financial business sector debt peaked in America at about 70% of GDP, large but far less than the Great Depression and sustainable, and it's now the household sector that's deleveraging from a much higher level of debt than they had back in the Great Depression. It was roughly 25% of GDP was the household debt level back in the early 1930s. It rose because of deflation, but it didn't get too high. This time we're starting at four times that level. But the trouble for households is they can't delever anywhere near as rapidly as businesses can, because businesses can get out of debt three ways. They can go bankrupt, they can stop investing, and they can sack the workers. Households find it very embarrassing to go bankrupt. It's very hard to stop consuming, and they can't sack the kids. So consequently, it's a very, very slow grinding deflation. When it comes to what the central banks and the governments are doing about that whole process, they are really afraid of a systemic breakdown in what you can pretty much call the repo market, the repurchase agreements that are a major part of how banks fund themselves by selling a bond or a financial instrument of some sort to another bank and agreeing to buy it back at a higher price slightly at a later period. That is such a fundamental part of the whole chain of payments between banks that the scare that all the central banks have is that that chain will break down. And it breaks down when a bank says, I'm not going to buy a bond off somebody and expect to, you know, sell it back to them at a higher price in 30 days' time, because I know my bonds are shonky, and therefore their bonds are likely to be shonky, and therefore the whole repayment scheme that exists at that level stops, and suddenly the whole banking system freezes. Now, that's the real fear they've got. The other fear, which we actually saw at the time of the Lehman Brothers collapse, was that Lehman Brothers had cornered the commercial paper market, and that's how these days, unfortunately, because banks have been so derelict in their duty, that's how non-financial corporations mainly fund themselves, by issuing very short-term paper to pay the wage bills and pay for the immaterial inputs and so on. And when Lehman failed, because they'd cornered the market, the commercial paper market failed, and that meant firms literally didn't have the money to pay wages that week. Now, that's what really put the bejesus up Hank Paulson, and they're afraid of a repeat of that. And it's quite possible that we would see a repeat if you had a series of banks folding, courtesy of what happens with the euro, or what's happening with unsuccessful plays on asset markets that we saw at J.P. Morgan recently.
Well, if to continue this on then, if the fear is, so if the repo market falls apart, I mean, it's really sort of the domino theory that the BBC put out this extraordinarily wonderful, very helpful graphic where they had a big circle and the countries were arrayed around and occupying portions of the circle, and then the fatness of the arrows going from one side of the circle to the other showed the amount that each country owed to the next country. And it's one, everybody owes everybody. In one giant sort of a circular piece. And so if everybody owes everybody and one person can't pay, it sort of knocks the whole thing off. If we look at this credit bubble, so I like to study bubbles, and there's a lot of historical examples, railroad bubbles, tulip bubbles, all kinds of wonderful bubbles. And they have a remarkable set of symmetries to them. One is a time symmetry, about as much time as they take to develop. They maybe just a little quicker, they unravel. And the second is they tend to sort of return from whence they came in terms of price levels. And so if we just nominally said, okay, we're just going to pick a number and say this credit bubble started just even 10 years ago. Let's start it in 2000. In the U.S., that means that we'd have roughly 20, 25 trillion of debts that would have to be unwound. We've maybe done, I don't know, 3 trillion of that, maybe something like that. Is it possible that in this unwinding, we're talking about you're talking about a wholesale destruction? There must be something the central banks can do that they haven't done. I have not yet received a time-sensitive check for $100,000 in my mailbox.
Well, that's what I actually want them to do. I think what the mistake they're trying to make is to try to continue honoring debts that should never have been created in the first place. And we really know that the subprime lending was totally irresponsible lending. And when it comes to saying who's responsible for bad debt, you've got to really blame the lender rather than the borrower, because the lenders have got far greater resources to work out whether or not the borrower can actually afford the debt they're putting out there. And they were creating debt just because it was a way of getting fees, short-term profit, and they then sold the debt on to unsuspecting members of the public as well and securitized their way out of trouble and gave the hot potato to the public. So you shouldn't be honoring that debt, you should be abolishing it. But of course, because they've actually packaged a lot of that debt and sold it to the public as well, you can't just abolish it, because you then would penalize people who actually thought they were being responsible in saving and buying assets. So I'm talking in favor of what I call a modern debt jubilee, or quantitative easing for the public, where the central banks would create central bank money. We can't destroy a great abolition of debt, which would also destroy the incomes of people who own the bonds banks have sold. We have to create the state money, give it to the public, but on condition that if you have any debt, you've got to pay your debt down. No question, no choice. Therefore, if you have debt, you can reduce the debt level. But if you don't have debt, you get a cash injection. Now, of course, this then would feed into the financial sector, which would have to reduce the value of the debts that it currently owns, which means income from debt instruments would also fall. So people who had debt instruments, had bought bonds, their retirement and so on, would find that their income would go down, but on the other hand, they'd be compensated by a cash injection. The one part of the system which would be reduced in size is the financial sector itself, and that's the part we have to reduce, have to make it smaller. So that's the proposal I'm putting forward, and I think it's got very little chance of being implemented in America for the next few years, none at all in my home country, because we still think we're doing, we're doing brilliantly down under. But I think at some stage in Europe, and possibly in a very short time frame, that idea might be considered, because the crisis in Europe, as we know, is giving us countries like Spain with unemployment rates of 25%. Social cohesion can't hold with unemployment at that level, particularly right, when the other policies that the governments are trying are battening down on the poor people who never benefited from the bubble in the first place.
Right. No, I completely understand your proposal. It makes sense. It makes more sense to me than on a number of levels, including the whole moral hazard level of basically making whole banks that where's their lesson in all of this? One thing we know about banks are if they don't learn their lesson, they will not learn their lesson. So I see J.P. Morgan's recent activities just demonstrating that business as usual will be returned to as soon as possible without some sort of corrective event of some kind.
Yeah, they have to suffer and suffer badly, and suffer in such a way that they'll at least for a decade or so be scarred from ever behaving this way again. We've got to reduce the financial sector to about one third its current size.
Here, here.
And we have to also ultimately set up financial institutions in such a way, financial instruments in such a way that it's no longer desirable from the public's point of view to borrow and gamble on rising asset prices. But that's the real mistake we made, to let this gambling happen as it has so many times in the past, but let it go on for far longer than we've ever let it go on before, and therefore we have a far greater financial parasite and a far greater crisis.
Understood. So let's imagine for private individuals, just how would you recommend protecting one's assets, one's wealth, one's purchasing power, one's future if, at this point in time?
Well, basically, the basic story is always in a situation like this, being in cash is the safest way to survive. So if you're in cash, you can at least make a, you're not going to be hit by debt problems, and you can be a vulture shopper, so to speak, if assets come on cheaply. So being in cash is the best idea. Of course, you can also make money by gambling on assets like gold. But the great danger is that I really don't trust that there's as much gold out there as people have bought. In certificate, I think we'll find plenty of fraud there too. Bill Black keeps on reminding that we've got to concern ourselves about fraud. And I think people who thought they've got gold, who've got gold certificates, might find they've actually got gold fraud on their hands. So I think the safest option overall is to be in cash of your national country. But of course, the great trouble about that is if you liquidate your debt and go into cash instead by selling assets, you help cause the process that brings the overall system down. So we can't just do the individual level. We have to get together. We have to campaign and change society to stop it being dominated by the finance sector. And that means acting collectively, which is a pretty rare event for Americans. But I think it's about time they gave it a try.
Well, we're going to try everything else first, but I'm with you. I understand you're finishing up a new book. Can you give us its title and a quick overview of what's in there?
Well, starting the next book. I'm actually thinking of writing a new one. I know Paul Krugman's put a book called End This Depression Now, and I think he's got the naive belief that you can just end the deficit with the crisis with a big enough government deficit. And he's ignoring the impact of private sector deleveraging because he ignores the role of debt. So I'm thinking of writing a book. I haven't quite thought of the title yet, but it will be going through the way that I model endogenous money creation and simulate a financial system, and then say, let's try a few different options here and see which one works best in the hypothetical economy, while also talking about the real levels of debt and the impact of private sector deleveraging. So I'm hoping to have that book started in about August and finished with a bit of luck by the beginning of next year.
All right, maybe a working title could be It's the Banks, Stupid.
That's not bad, Chris. I might even owe you one film copyright for that.
Yes. that'll sell well in America anyway. Well, fantastic. So how can people follow your work, and where are they going to find your book when it comes out?
Okay. Well, of course, Debunking Economics is the second edition is around in the lab right now. They can buy that on Amazon today if they felt like it, and on Kindle, and, of course, in the local bookshop. And my blog, I have a blog called www.debtdeflation.com/blogs. And we're about to rationalize those websites, by the way, and change the way I interact with the public a bit. So I hope it gets rather less complicated than my current system. But that's the main blog, Steve Keen's Debt Watch, www.debtdeflation.com/blogs. And you might listen to the podcast of the BBC Radio 4 Analysis Program, which is going to air in about 10 minutes when we're recording. It'll be up on the podcast site for BBC Radio 4 this week.
Fantastic. We'll put a link to that as well at the bottom of this when this loads up at chrismartinson.com. So thank you so much, first, for the work that you're doing, and second, for taking as much time as you do to explain it and make sure, you know, spread the word as widely as you can. It's such an important dialogue and debate to be having. And thank you for coming on this program.
Welcome, mate. I'm glad you're there.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.